Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Nichols, who was recently on the podcast. I get to speak to him again on another fascinating recent publication. He is professor of religious studies at Martin University. And today we get to speak on Malleable Mara, the transformations of a Buddhist symbol of evil. Michael, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me back again. Honored to be here.
Great. So maybe a quick word on Mara. That name will probably mean a lot to many people and not a lot to many people. So who is Mara?
Yeah. Great question to start off with. And you're right. This is a figure known to some, but certainly not all. Within Buddhist traditions, the figure of Mara represents the union of desire and death. This is a collapse of the categories of demon and God, and Mara is seen as overseeing the turning of the wheel of samsara, so life, death, and rebirth. He's a figure who works to keep beings trapped within that realm. And so as the goal of Buddhism is escape from that realm, Mara is the antagonist in a lot of Buddhist narratives, Buddhist psychological theory, because he's seen as being an inner and outer force, a deity who works externally on beings, and also he's an internalized force, sometimes spoken of metaphorically throughout Buddhist traditions as the essence that keeps beings from wanting to turn towards attempts at awakening. Quite possibly the most famous story that Buddhists tell and that people who study the Buddhist tradition or even don't study might have come across about Mara is his attempts right at the moment of Siddhartha Gautama's right when he's on the precipice of achieving awakening at Bodh Gaya, Mara intervenes and uses a number of different stratagems to try to stop Gautama from achieving Buddhahood, because this would constitute a challenge to Mara's authority. That's the Buddhist teaching is what subverts his ability to keep beings trapped within the realm of samsara. So a little word on Mara, and he, as the book describes, has had a presence throughout Buddhist traditions from ancient India, throughout the rest of Asia, and even up through convert Buddhism as you find it within European and North American Buddhist traditions.
So what is the object of study? Whereby are you gleaning insights into this mythological figure?
So primarily, this is a textual analysis. So I look at texts and stories and myths and traditions about Mara throughout Asian traditions. Much of the book does focus on Indian Buddhism, the early Pali texts up through Mahayana Buddhism, but there's a chapter that goes through later Asian traditions in China and Japan, Southeast Asia, and also a chapter on the presence of Mara within the convert Buddhists in Western traditions. And that one does get a little bit into some media studies. And there is a very limited amount of material culture and art that I look at, but primarily this is a textual study, a comparison of these stories of Mara across these Buddhist traditions and also within those different cultural frameworks, because the thesis of the book is that Mara really serves as a barometer in all of those different appearances for the ways in which Buddhist communities are responding to the social and doctrinal concerns that they have and using Mara to express those things that are very particular to their brands of Buddhism and their cultural moment of Buddhism, and also to paint and demonize sectarian rivals, whoever those happen to be. And that changes, of course, depending on the context of the particular Buddhist tradition that you're looking at.
So you've preempted one of my questions in stating the general thesis or gist of the book. Maybe this would be a good opportunity to talk about the layout of the book and maybe touch on the ways in which each chapter contributes to the argument you're making.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the first chapter really lays out, in the book, I should say, just as an overview, proceeds rather chronologically. So from earliest representations of Mara within early Indian Buddhism, all the way to the final chapter, which is about Western Buddhist traditions. So really, the first chapter lays out some of the theoretical concerns, sets some of the stage, introducing who and what Mara is, as we touched on briefly a few moments ago, that Mara is not terribly widely known outside of Buddhism, although there have been a couple of studies regarding Mara. Some of those go back a ways. One of the earliest was in 1895 by a German scholar, Ernst Windisch, and you don't find a whole lot of other works about Mara. And so this book was an attempt to do something that had not been done previously, which is to take a real longitudinal diachronic study of the figure and look at the ways it had developed and look at the different changes and emphases about Mara. And so the first chapter really tries to lay out some of that framework about why the study was necessary, the ways in which that kind of point of view and analysis of the figure would be helpful to scholarship, to look at how using the figure could be a lens into the concerns of different Buddhist groups across time. Then the next cluster of chapters, the second, third, and fourth, really focus primarily on Indian Buddhism in Pali texts and a few couple of Sanskrit texts, looking at the ways in which Mara was kind of created. The genesis of Mara was largely, at least I argue in those chapters, a way to differentiate Buddhism from Hindu competitors by drawing upon a number of Hindu stories and then subverting and redeploying the symbolism. To take one example, if you look at that famous Bodh Gaya narrative in a text, for instance, like Buddhacharita by Ashwagosha, he very deliberately labels Mara as Kamadeva, which a scholar of Hinduism would recognize as the name of the god of desire, Kama. At the same time, there are elements of the representation, such as Mara's army, these beings that Mara calls upon to try to actually kill Gautama before he can achieve awakening, can be construed as having a great deal of similarities to the gunas of Shiva, also to the figures that are associated with Yama. So in a lot of ways, Mara is a pastiche of different Hindu deities. Different aspects of Hindu deities come together in a way to form this figure, and there is a not-so-subtle kind of demonization of the cosmology of Hinduism at the same time that God, in a sense, is a being which is trying to entrap humans and others within the realm of samsara. And the Buddha is the one who is going to overthrow that kind of tyranny. At the same time, you have demonic influences in there from the much smaller kinds of local deities like Yakas to Vritra and Nemuchi, the names of which are explicitly used in other instances in Buddhist texts. So chapter two kind of lays the foundation again for who and what Mara is within these Pali narratives. Chapter 3 focuses on the demonic attributes that are put upon Mara by these early Buddhist texts. And chapter 4 really levels the charge about Mara being this pastiche of Hindu deities. Chapter 5, we notice the flip that occurs. With the rise of the Mahayana traditions, the tensions within Buddhism, not that these didn't exist prior, but these really come to the fore, become more internal. And so Mahayana Buddhist texts deploy Mara as ways of differentiating themselves from other Buddhists. So at those points in those texts, you have rhetorics of Mara being able to take the form of other Buddhists, of Mara's rhetoric about the Mahayana being a form of attempts by other Buddhists to try to knock the Mahayana vehicle off course. So that chapter really does look at the internal strife that occurs, that when Mara can become a way to talk about rival Buddhists, the sectarian differentiation is now internalized. Chapter 6 is kind of a tour of Asian traditions. I go through the Chinese, Tibetan, Japanese, and Southeast Asian deployments of the figure. And those, again, look at how local concerns then become the primary means of using the figure, so that the concerns in those particular regions in those particular times come to the fore. And then finally, to wrap up the book, we look at how Mara is used within North American and British contexts to talk about concerns that are particular in those areas. So half of that chapter looks at how Mara really, in a way, becomes shorthand for a number of these writers in a self-help sort of way. And that way, it somewhat mirrors the Western grappling with other terms, like, I think, analogy with the way yoga is used. He's taking ancient Asian tradition and using it to talk about anti-consumerism, anti-capitalism. We find the same thing with Mara. Although most interesting to me in that chapter also is the how you find Mara in popular culture. The chapter spends a lot of time talking about the way in which maybe one particular convert Buddhist, Christopher Bailey, who was a writer for the Doctor Who television show, used Mara as a villain in several episodes of a run of a mid-1980s Doctor Who series, which show a conflation of a number of theological Western ideas with Buddhist notions, and what becomes an interesting kind of syncretism. The same with another text called Letter from Mara, which also is covered in that chapter, where a Canadian convert Buddhist wrote a short pamphlet where he cribbed C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters and instead wrote it as Letters from Mara. And again, which syncretizes some Western theological notions with the ancient Buddhist figure of Mara. So that's kind of a real quick sweep over the different chapters of the book and how it tries to do this kind of longitudinal study of the different concerns you find layered within Mara throughout the whole text and the whole sweep of Buddhist history. And the closing line that I used in the text is that one of the things that has stayed the same about Mara throughout his history and throughout whatever Buddhist tradition you're talking about is his propensity to be a shapeshifter, which is something that can put you kind of ill at ease, that Mara can be anything and anyone at any point in time. And the book kind of takes that to another level, saying, if you look at the sweep of Buddhist history, that has definitely been true, because Mara has taken so many different forms over all of this time.
That's a great summation of the chapters of the book. Can you say a bit more about the methodology in terms of, you know, on this podcast, we've had other authors who've studied mythological characters over large spans of time. What come to mind are Adisate's work on Vishamitra. We have the Parashurama work by Brian Collins. But tell us a bit about, you know, how do you study this character over time? Are we focusing on the use of the character in a particular context? Are we focusing on continuities? Is it something other than this? Say a bit about that for our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both, where you look at the different contexts on their own terms and try to determine what is of primary importance to the particular community you're talking about at the moment, and try to read each of those instances on its own to determine on that basis, and using outside sources as well when there are moments where you know what a particular historical concern of a community was. That can give you an in. That can give you another lens to look at what the deployment of Mara in that particular instance is. And then between the different time periods, right? To see, because that helps you to reveal exactly where some of those added layered elements happen to be. Using an example from the last chapter that I was just talking about, within the Doctor Who television series, Mara is represented continuously. His primary form is as a giant snake. Now, when we look back at other examples of uses of Mara within the Indian, Tibetan, Southeast Asian, Chinese, Japanese traditions, we don't find a number of great examples of Mara as a snake. There is one particular instance of Mara taking the form of a giant snake, very isolated, very brief, within some of the polytechs, the Mara Sanyuta of the Sanyuta Nikaya. This is an element that was added by Christopher Bailey. And some of the extra element, the interviews with Christopher Bailey that you read, he talks very explicitly about how his own background within Christian traditions led him to interpret his different writings. And so it's not too far of a stretch to say in that particular context, you have something of a Christian element being added to this Buddhist mythological figure. Although at the time within that particular Doctor Who episode, he's making a number of comments about consumption and commodification. So he's both responding to his particular moment within history through this text. And he's also drawing upon elements to syncretize at the same time, kind of even subconsciously in some ways. In terms of different theoreticians that I've used to try to make those combinations, those interpretations come alive, ones that were particularly helpful to me were Mikhail Bakhtin, this notion of the dialogic imagination, about the embedding of the dialogic that all comments are in some ways responses to others. That was very helpful for thinking about how Mara from the beginning was not a character that just emerges out of whole cloth, out of nothing, that this is a figure that was used from his very earliest inception to respond to other cultural figures. He was drawing upon the Indian imagination. And that's something that you find throughout the figure of Mara. James Liska, a semiotician of mythology, was also very helpful. His concept of transvaluation, where when you compare different texts and sometimes different versions of the same story, quote unquote, and you look at the elements that have been altered and changed, his very, very simple theory, which I found to be a very, very helpful theory. So when you look at those elements that have been shifted and changed, those are the places where you can find the different values of the particular community to author that text coming to the fore. So when you look at the different versions, the different imaginations of the story, say, of Bodhgaya, the way that it's portrayed within art, the way that it's portrayed within text, then those small differences come to the fore. And you can use those as ways of understanding what the particular concerns of that community would be, why they changed what they did. And also other comparative mythologists like Wendy Doniger and Bruce Lincoln, who have looked at the reimagination of mythology over time, the way that symbols change and the way that you can look at those changes as being not just accidental, but as being deliberate. So that kind of as a summation is some of the theoretical and methodological background.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, perhaps unsurprising, I find it an intriguing prospect of looking at a mythological character over a large span of time. I had in the back of my brain to do a book called Mapping Markandeya. Mm-hmm. It became a chapter of book two, so I think I'm sated with that for now, but perhaps at some point and look at a great Hindu sage over the various textual cultural iterations. And there's this really rich tension of, well, are we looking at, for example, Markandeya in a particular context? Are we looking at a Markandeya that sort of transcends those and continues beyond them? It reminds me of this this teaching tale someone shared with me once. You know, I think this might be from ancient Greek philosophy, actually. You know, I had a jackknife for 40 years, same jackknife. Sometimes I change the handle, and then sometimes I change the blade. Mm-hmm. It's the same knife I've had for 40 years. I digress, clearly. Why is this character so implicated in psychology, study of psychology?
Mm. That's a good question. That's a good question. And so that is one of the themes in the book, is how the internalization of Morrow kind of comes to the fore. And it's particularly one that gets latched upon by Western Buddhists, by convert Buddhists. And there's a particular reason, I think, for that. But first, I think within the Buddhist tradition, it really speaks to the macrocosmic, but also the microscopic level of Morrow's control. I think Buddhism, from its beginning, and Dharma as a term, can be read and interpreted and translated a number of different ways, as religion, as philosophy, as psychology. So Buddhists have always been very interested in the inner workings of the mind, because so much about grasping and desire has to do with mental processes. So it makes a lot of sense that the obstacles to one having correct understanding, correct knowledge, and ultimately achieving awakening would be seen as also internalized as part of human psychology. So it makes a lot of sense for Morrow to also have a foothold and to live to a great extent within human psychology. And so there is, in the later traditions, a development called the Four Morrows, which one of the four happens to be the Deva, the god, the large macrocosmic Mara, shown as holding the wheel of death and rebirth. And the others have to do with mental processes as a way, a commentarial way of trying to break down this huge expansive figure into subcategories, I think, you know, largely as a pedagogical way of understanding Mara, as a way of teaching about the different practices that Buddhists have to do in order to overcome the obstacles of Mara. So Buddhism has always been interested in psychology. So this makes all kinds of sense that Morrow would figure in that and be a part of that teaching. But, you know, as the book shows, Morrow's also been understood, you know, not just as a psychological figure, but also as this narrative figure, as this deity that kind of bestrides the world. That part becomes lesser emphasized within Western Buddhism, and what has been termed by some other scholars the sort of Protestant Buddhism, because I think of that turn towards the seeing Buddhism, those who have been drawn to Buddhism in the West oftentimes do so as a way to work against what they see as the organized religion, try to drain it of its mythological components. A great example of this is a figure like Stephen Batchelor, who has written quite a bit on his own interpretation of Mara. And Stephen Batchelor, for those who are not familiar, is a British convert Buddhist who's written books like Buddhism Without Beliefs, where he believes that a totally, from his point of view, rationalized Buddhism, scientific Buddhism, is the most appropriate sort of tradition and sort of practice. And he has wrote a second book called Living with the Devil, where his interpretation of Mara is entirely metaphorical, entirely psychological, just as the inner workings of the mind that a person needs to overcome. And that valence is certainly within ancient Buddhist texts. It's not the primary one that you find, even within modern Buddhist traditions, but it's one that gets emphasized by those Western convert Buddhists who want to interpret Buddhism as primarily a philosophy and a psychology. And so that was an interesting dynamic to look at in that last chapter, how a figure which had had such rich traditions as a mythic entity, then is seen as a figure without mythology. What do you do when you take away that mythic element? When you deduct that from the equation, what's left? And the sorts of stories you get left are things like Stephen Batchelor creates, or the metaphor for the psychology that you get within a story like the Doctor Who episodes that I look at.
Would you share your thoughts on such movements? In terms of, for example, looking to Buddhist teachings or practices, but sort of plucked from a specific religious context, used more for psychology. Could you give us a sense of what you think of that?
Well, I approach it primarily as another example of data, of other materials to look at. One hallmark of Buddhism throughout its history has been change. As it's moved through different cultures, those different cultures have interpreted and reinterpreted from their own points of view. Mara is a fantastic example of that process and how it occurs. And so what has sometimes been called from practitioners within the West, the new Buddhism, is just another artifact of that. And so I find it a really interesting way to compare how these traditions have changed over time, to put the one against the other. It has been a fascinating scholarly enterprise. From my own point of view, as someone who got into the study of religion because of the richness of narratives and the way that they can spark imagination, the way that they can really enliven one's own personal beliefs, I guess I do have a sense that I like to keep the magic within the mythology. I like to see those things as being worthy of meaning and not, as sometimes you see phrased in some of these texts, just mythology. But that's a very personal interpretation. As a scholar, I find the comparison and the change over time the thing that I focus on primarily.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your personal stance and your connection to this. Likewise, I feel that enchantment's important one way or another, particularly in perhaps our very disenchanted times. Nevertheless, all movements, whether they're iterations, whether they're adaptations, whether they're new religious movements, they make for fascinating objects of inquiry without question. What would you say is the key takeaway of your book? Like, what's the key argument you're making? Mm-hmm. I know you touched on it, but in a nutshell.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that when you look at Mara over time, you find that Mara is used a close connection to whatever the social and doctrinal concerns are of the particular Buddhist community that you're looking at. So Mara has been used to reinforce what were considered the essential teachings of a particular group and to literally demonize whoever that particular group considered at that time to be a sectarian rival. So Mara has been a vessel into which any Buddhist group could pour their particular concerns. He, in a very protean way, would take whatever form they needed him to take.
In terms of your chapters, case studies, examples of this demonization, is there one in particular that's most remarkable to you or surprising in some way or gripping, or, you know, is there a particular instance that stands out to you?
One of the ones that has always stuck out to me from my very earliest studies of Mara, and I should say that, you know, my study of Mara goes back a long ways. I first became interested in the figure as an undergraduate. And then my master's thesis, I took a small sliver of this to work on, and then a little bit bigger for my doctoral dissertation, heavily revised both, added lots of layers and other, you know, kind of accordioned out the whole thing into a book. So this is from about 2002 onward, up to 2019 was the whole journey of putting the book together. And so I compiled a lot of those instances of demonization throughout there. One that has stuck out to me that goes back to one of the very earliest strata of research is a moment from the early Mahayana text, the Perfection of Wisdom literature, where the Buddha is said to instruct those who are first going out onto the Bodhisattva path that you may have members of other Buddhist vehicles come to you and tell you that this teaching, the Perfection of Wisdom, is a work of Mara. Now, bear in mind that those who tell you this is a work of Mara themselves are denizens of Mara and have been enslaved by Mara, and goes on and on. And so what I found so fascinating about that was, you know, the anticipation, the way that Mara is in a way being batted back and forth like a tennis ball, as you can see, I think, enshrined in there, the fact that Mara was very heavily used in this rhetoric between the two sects, and that they either had received that charge that the Perfection of Wisdom was a work of Mara, or they were anticipating it And so the most logical thing for them to do was to redirect it back. That's, you know, the most heinous thing that they could do is say, no, you are a work of Mara. And so the finger pointing, I found just fascinating in that one little piece of the perfection of wisdom. That told me a lot about the way that Mara was being deployed in that context there.
A couple of thoughts come to mind randomly, of course. The first is Madhvacharya's literal demonization of Shankara, mm-hmm. as having come to destroy the world, essentially. Also, this principle, it's Maya, right? It's a hall of mirrors. Like, which one is the Maya? Like, let's put it this way. I imagine that if you pay attention to certain places in the globe as it is, you'll see two different factions, each demonizing the other. Mm-hmm. Wherein lies the truth, right? So I can relate to why that's compelling. It's so human, isn't it? And then how do you know? How do you know which one's a doppelganger, right? How do you know which one's real? And you thank you for sharing a bit of the story of how you got interested in this. Had I had more coffee this morning, I would have asked that at the outset of this interview. But no, the truth is I was doing a bit of research up to like the minute before the interview. I'm like, oh, I gotta go. So I'm glad we got a bit of that backstory, despite my haze at the moment. Is this a myth cycle, a figure that you will continue to work on?
I think so. I think so. Definitely, they're in smaller bites, in smaller chunks, because there are things that I think keep arising that get me interested in the figure. And one of the things that I left undone in the book. Is there implicit and maybe in little bits and chunks, it was a little bit more of the comparative element of looking at Mara and the wider constellation of other figures of evil and also of more of what is considered in categories and defined as evil culturally. And also in this larger category that I've become interested in of the quote unquote monstrous, what is defined as being monstrous. And one of the things that I might like to do with the figure is to look at the ways we can use some of those categories to carry out comparison between Mara and other figures. One of the, I think, infelicitous ways that Mara has been compared in the past has been a very quick and dirty connection to the Christian figure of Satan. And there are definitely some connections there, but you did in some of the older scholarship especially find quick offhand references to Mara as the quote-unquote Buddhist Satan, which I think elides a lot of the differences and, of course, you know, casts Mara in some ways that are square peg and round hole. But I think a really good comparison, not just to figures within the Christian context, but to other figures around the world, might be interesting to carry out using some of the theoretical tools like the monstrous, like that term. Are there ways in which that helps us to look at Mara in a wider lens beyond just figures that seem like the immediate comparison?
Who might be interested most in reading this book, or otherwise put, sort of what interests and or subfields does it contribute to?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's, you know, Buddhist studies certainly is a field that would be interested in this because of the wide swath. And I think scholars in Buddhist studies across different traditions, scholars of South Asia in general, since so much of the book is about Indian Buddhism and the connection between Indian Buddhism and Hindu traditions, I think would find the connections interesting. Those in broader religious studies who like to look at longitudinal studies, development of narratives over time about rhetorics of demonization, I think would find this to be an interesting study. I do draw upon monster theory, the theory of the monstrous, in a number of occasions throughout the book. And so I think that scholars who have an interest in those sorts of figures would find this to be a worthwhile book to take a look at.
Speaking of monsters, there was a really great, it's actually a master's thesis on behalf of a student of my doctoral advisor, on looking at monstrous themes to understand Kali, the goddess Kali in the Devi Mahatmya. Fascinating stuff. Yet again, I digress. Is there anything else about the book that you wish to touch upon before we close today?
I think that, primarily this was a book that was a a labor of love. And because it took a long while to put together and saw many different iterations. And so as my first book, it was an extraordinarily gratifying experience to see something that I had first dreamed of when I was a very, very early graduate student, you know, take physical form to be able to hold it in my hands at the end. That was a great moment. And so having its genesis, you know, very early on in this moment where I looked at a polytext and a few days later quite accidentally looked at a Mahayana text and saw two very different visions of Mara and kind of thought, well, what happened in between the two? And, you know, the book emerged from that, just that very, very simple observation. It's just been a great journey along the way, many years. And so I hope that there are people out there who enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it and putting it together, and then find it helpful.
I hope you're listening out there, all you grad students, you know, hold on to those ideas and germinate them because, you know, you may end up publishing a fantastic book one day and you never know, maybe being on this podcast or another such podcast. thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
As did I. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Michael Nichols on a 2019 SUNY publication entitled Malleable Mara, The Transformations of a Buddhist Symbol of Evil. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating how mythic motifs change over time. Take care.